from deep inside your radio.
Well, there's 10 seconds I'm never going to see again. Ladies and gentlemen, from Providence, Rhode Island, this edition of the broadcast originates. And first of all, the new Iraq, because somebody's got to talk about it. The Iraqi government says it is going to double the salaries of university professors as part of a bid to stem the brain drain in the country. It's the brain drain. Their brains are draining. Hard Day's Night, 1965. Doctors, teachers, and businessmen have left Iraq because they feel unsafe. So pay them more. This is from the BBC. No exact figures are available, and a government spokesman said there was little in reality that could be done to solve the problem. In reality. So let's talk about the other area. Under Saddam Hussein, around 4 million people are thought to have left, among them some of Iraq's top professionals. After the war, some exiles did return, but more than 2 years after the war ended, the country's brain drain, far from being reversed, is continuing at a rate that is alarming many Iraqis. University teachers will see their salaries doubled to try to keep them in the country. The problem is not confined to the campus. Doctors are fleeing, too. A junior radiologist said many of her senior colleagues had left Iraq already because of kidnappings and death threats. This is the main problem we're facing now in the hospital, she said. Most of the senior doctors have fled the country, and I believe not only the doctors, all the expertise. Doctors have been threatened and kidnapped. Dozens of university teachers have been killed. A senior government official said he believed Iraqi professionals were being deliberately and systematically targeted. New Iraq, ladies and gentlemen, but in case you'd like to get involved, representatives from 15 countries have registered to attend the fourth Rebuilding Iraq conference so far. According to New Fields Exhibitions, the organizer of the July 2022 conference in Washington, D.C., I'm on their mailing list. Middle Eastern countries have taken a strong interest in the event, pointing to an eagerness throughout the region to contribute to the rebuilding process. Quote, the rebuilding process in Iraq is an international effort, as can be seen by the companies from 15 countries that have already registered for our fourth Rebuilding Iraq conference. I forgot to share with you when I got the first three invites. The conference is a latest installment of a series of events, I'm reading from their press release, that brought together Iraqi government ministers, U.S. government decision makers. I thought Iraq was sovereign. Prime contractors, Iraqi entrepreneurs, and hundreds of American business leaders. They met in 2003 and 2004 to network and devise solutions for the modernization of Iraq. Topics at the fourth rebuilding conference will include security, contracting and subcontracting opportunities, working with the Iraqi government, and much more. Hey, here's a business you might want to look into in the new Iraq. According to the Washington Post, Hamid Godse, president of the United Nations International Narcotics Control Board, said since the U.S.-led invasion in 2003, Iraq has become a transit point in the flow of hashish and heroin from Iran and Afghanistan to Europe and the Persian Gulf. It's the new Iraq. It's a transit point. Hey, there's good money in that. Under Hussein's rule, alcoholism and addiction to medication such as Valium prevailed, health officials say in Iraq. The use of illegal drugs was thought to be rare. But since the invasion, the same porous borders that U.S. and Iraqi officials describe as conduits for foreign insurgents have become well-traveled smuggling routes for drug traffickers. As a result, the health ministry of Iraq says addiction rates are climbing steadily. The new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. Hey, but there's the Constitution. They're writing a Constitution. They're writing that whole new Constitution. And given how easily that whole process has gone in Europe, Deadline Baghdad, political leaders of Iraq's Sunni minority, Friday rejected a compromise offer that would give them more say in the drafting of the Constitution. Otherwise, there's seemingly sectarian unrest in a country that Paul Wolfowitz said didn't have a history of ethnic conflict. A spokesman for the Gathering of the Sunni People said they would hold out for 25 seats against the 15 that were offered in the compromise. A spokesman said they would boycott negotiations if arbitration by a three-person panel failed to settle a matter. Sounds like negotiations in the NBA, but it's the new Iraq. And finally, on the subject of subcontractors, This from, I believe, the Telegraph in London. Iraq's interior ministry says it wants to impose legal boundaries on the private security business after American contractors twice opened fire on U.S. Marines. The move may be supported by the U.S. military, whose patience with the contractors has been tested. Now, let's just review, ladies and gentlemen. These are contractors who hire guys who normally have been trained by the military at our expense, do their little service in the military, leave, and then go do the same job for a much higher salary for the private contractors. So why wouldn't Marines resent them, for example? And why wouldn't we have trouble recruiting for the military when they're facing these guys who are doing their jobs at three times? The Marines say one of their combat teams came under fire from guards in a convoy of four-wheel drives belonging to Zapata Engineering, a firm based in North Carolina that's involved in reconstruction projects. A Marine observation post was fired 3 hours later by the same convoy, according to a Marine spokesman. The contractors' vehicles were eventually stopped by metal spikes in the road. Hey, there's severe tire damage in Iraq, too. I feel closer to them now, somehow. Soldiers promptly arrested the security men, 16 Americans and 3 Iraqis, who were detained and have since been sent home. See, if you actually fire on Marines, you get detained for a little while and get sent home. If an Afghani warlord has sold you into detention, you stay in Guantanamo till they close it. A lawyer who's representing two of the contractors claims that at one point a Marine shouted at the contractors, quote, "How does it feel to be a rich contractor now?" The new Iraq, ladies and gentlemen. Let's all go. Hello, welcome to the show.
The sea, the sky, and you and I. Sea and sky and you and I. No, all blues, all shades, all hues, all blues. Some blues are sad, but some are glad. Dark and sad, or bright and glad, they're all blues, all shades. A color, the blues are more than a color. They are a moan of pain, a taste of strife, a sad refrain against which life is playing. Blues can be Lord, in a rainbow, a summer day that's fair, a prayer that's prayed, lament that's made, or goodbye said. Some shade of blue is there, blue, heaven's blue. They are all blues. The sea,
from Providence, Rhode Island, home of a guy whose name I mispronounced on last week's show. Imagine that, ladies and gentlemen. And I'm correcting it myself. Ex-Mayor Buddy Cianci. Mayor Buddy. Coming out soon. Anyway, from Providence, Rhode Island. Little estate. It's so cute here. I'm Harry Shearer, welcoming you to this edition of the show. And now, before we do anything else, I've already done other things, but before we do anything more else, allow me to read the trades for you, would you? You really, well, you do have a choice. We always know you have a choice in airlines. And your call is important to us. Aside from that, this is from... Interesting where this is from. It says CSNews.com. Shell stations cater to entertainment-starved customers. I'll read it for you. Oh, because you are so entertainment-starved. Ladies and gentlemen, select Shell oil stations in the Los Angeles area. We are busting our buttons about this. We'll debut the VST Media Network, offering news, sports, and entertainment to drivers while they fill their tanks. The system from VST Media runs, guess what? That's correct, paid advertising, in addition to reporting news, sports, and entertainment, plus movie trailers. You haven't seen enough of those in elevators? Public service announcements, and emergency alerts. When the pumps are not in use, screens cycle through a series of on-site promotional offerings. Lifting the fuel nozzle from the dispenser triggers the start of a 2 to 3 minute programming loop matched to the average consumer fueling time. The loop features a maximum of 6 15-second ads. That's a minute and a half out of a 2 to 3 minute programming loop, ladies and gentlemen. I just did the math for you. Says Leighton Hull, president and CEO of Pacific Fuels, which has installed the monitors at 10 of its sites, we believe the VST Media Network will help lift sales and provide an entertaining value add, he hyphenated them, or somebody did, for our customers. The monitors can be used to promote specific campaigns that drive motorists into the convenience store, or as he calls it, the C store. Not the C section. The great thing is that we can measure any campaign, such as how many customers saw the promotions and the associated sales lifts of the specific product promoted on the network. Says Sam Anabi, president of another outfit which has installed the network at 3 locations. Consumers welcome the entertainment and informational value of the network and are motivated by the on-screen advertising. As a dealer, the VST Media Network allows me to help monetize the investments I have made in real estate and operations, unquote. Everybody wants to be in show business, ladies and gentlemen. The network features 17-inch daylight viewable screens and stereo sound mounted on gas pumps. And as if that's not enough, and you know it's not, from broadcasting and cable, TV viewers better brace themselves for even more product placement in their favorite TV shows. CBS chairman Les Moonves says he's planning a big increase. I think, he says, you're going to see a quantum leap, not the Scott Bakula show, in the number of products integrated into your television shows this year. Unquote. Moonves, speaking of your television shows, he wasn't speaking to you. He was speaking to investors at Deutsche Bank's annual media conference in New York. He was trying to calm anxiety about the threatened disruption of TV advertising by digital television recorders. Moonves says that while NBC's The Apprentice may have, quote, taken that model and overdid it there, unquote, CBS will be heavily salting much of its programming with product placements. We're making more and more of those deals, he says. The kind of cars they drive in CSI. The kind of orange juice they drink in 2 and a Half Men. I didn't know they drank orange juice in 2 and a Half Men. But you see, I don't... One aspect of the TV business that will be slow to develop is video on demand. Ultimately, Moonves would like to be selling previously aired episodes of CSI at $1 per viewing. The results, Moonves says, are really rather inconclusive. Number one, I don't think people are running for video on demand on 48 hours. It's not something you run home and say, oh my God, I missed 48 hours this week. I've got to catch up with it, unquote. I'm sure the 48 hours team appreciates the support, Les. Advertising on your gas pumps, product placement in your television, ladies and gentlemen. It's almost as good as the new Iraq, but it's the new America. Brought to your attention when I read the trades for you. Copyrighted feature of this broadcast. And more about the new Iraq. More news from outside that bubble. We don't talk to terrorists, ladies and gentlemen, except when we have to. From The Guardian in England. American diplomats and army commanders have held indirect talks with insurgents in Iraq, otherwise known as terrorists. This is the first officially sanctioned contact between the two sides since the violence began following the end of the war, which apparently is still going on, despite the fact that it ended. A U.S. embassy official in Baghdad said efforts were underway to, quote, engage elements of the resistance in an apparent softening of the Bush administration's opposition to negotiation. But it's not. We're not talking to the terrorists. We're engaging with them, ladies and gentlemen. That's what you quote. In order to achieve stability and an end to the insurgency and stop Iraqis from being killed in large numbers, the insurgency has to be addressed, the official said. I don't think the people we are sitting in the room with are directly operational, but they have relationships with them, sometimes through family ties, sometimes just through Alan Thicke. No, that's a bad joke, ladies and gentlemen. Wasn't he on Family Ties? Wasn't that him? Sometimes through previous associations with the previous regime. Can I put more previouses in that quote? The official then asked. The briefing was on the record, but under embassy rules, the official could not be named. He didn't elaborate on the substance of the talks and was unclear which of the insurgency's numerous groups have been engaged. We didn't hear this on TV, did we? They were talking to the terrorists? Wonder why. Speaking of the contractors... Speaking of Iraqis being killed, Interior Ministry officials say at least 12 Iraqi civilians are killed every week by American private contractors in Baghdad alone. Enough is enough, said an official at the Interior Ministry. The culture of impunity must stop. I like that culture. That's the kind of, you know, when you say America has no culture, you who hate... Oh, by the way, the story has made it into the bubble about the memo, the new British memo, not the Downing Street memo. This would be, I guess, Downing Street 2. But some of the details that are most interesting, one has to go to the Times of London. Even though, yes, I know it's owned by Rupert Murdoch. Listen to this. Ministers were warned, British cabinet ministers, that is, not guys who pray. Cabinet ministers were warned in July 2002, almost 3 years ago, almost a year before the war, 9 months before the war, that Britain was committed to taking part in an American-led invasion of Iraq and that they had no choice but to find a way of making it legal. The warning in a leaked cabinet office briefing paper said Tony Blair had already agreed to back military action to get rid of Saddam Hussein in a summit at the Texas ranch of President Bush 3 months earlier. That would be July, June, May, April 2002, at a time when we were told, oh, no decision has been made yet. Why do we persist in looking backwards, we were asked? Because the results have been so damn good so far, that's why. The briefing paper for participants in a meeting of Blair's Inner Circle in July 2002 said since regime change was illegal, it was, quote, necessary to create the conditions, unquote, which would make it legal. This was required because even if the cabinet decided that Britain should not take part, the American military would be using British bases. This would automatically make Britain complicit in any illegal U.S. action. The paper was circulated to those present at the meeting, British Defense Secretary, British Foreign Secretary, and Sir Richard Dearlove, author of the Downing Street memo, head of British intelligence. Document said the only way that allies could justify military action was to place Saddam Hussein in a position where he ignored or rejected a United Nations ultimatum urging him to cooperate with the weapons inspectors, but it warned this would be difficult. It is just possible that an ultimatum could be cast in terms which Saddam would reject, the document says. But if he accepted it and did not attack the Allies, they would be most unlikely to obtain the legal justification they need. The suggestion that the Allies use the UN to justify war contradicts, this is at the London Times talking, contradicts claims by Blair and Bush that they turned to the UN in order to avoid having to go to war. The new Downing Street memo, ladies and gentlemen, for your listening pleasure. And now, another copyrighted feature of this broadcast, Tales of Airport Security. Haven't had one of these in a while. But we're having one now. See, that's how it works. Dear Harry, I've been meaning to write to tell you about an experience I had at Chicago's O'Hare Airport over the holiday season. My boyfriend and I went to Chicago to visit my family over the holiday season. Our return flight to Los Angeles was on January 5. After checking in, we proceeded to the security screening area in order to go to our gate. As we approached the security screening area, I noticed that there were several lines roped off where security personnel were checking ID and our boarding passes. Hardly anyone was in line, and so the flow of travelers easily moved along. In between these roped-off lines were empty lines. Empty in that they did not have security personnel posted at their end, nor were they roped off at their end. My boyfriend proceeded to one of the lines at which a security person was stationed, perhaps a little confused about why there were plainly open walkways through which one could walk without being stopped, or perhaps wishing to be a bit rebellious. I walked through adjacent to where he was standing, through one of the empty lines. Looking to my left and right, wondering whether or not to cough up my ID, but I was not stopped by any security personnel. After my carry-on baggage was screened, I went to my gate, boarded my flight, never having had to show my ID to anyone during the entire airport experience. Tales of Airport Security, ladies and gentlemen, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
From my game for reminiscing, can you blame a ladies' man? might my powers have got instead had I not shot so much in bed? A lady's man. What tricky trade might I have tried had I not laid preoccupied? But then who's ever satisfied? A lady's man. The women I made frequently, each in her heart held secretly that she was really making me a lady's man. A woman feels, a man may guess, that she conceals beneath her dress a trap in which she can possess a lady's man. Yeah. She throws the bait, she shows the lure. There's no escaping, that's for sure. You're never really free when you're a lady's man. Each fellow follows his own star, but take no appetite too far. That's sound advice in case you are a lady's man. But you call all this sour grapes. Devote yourself to willing rapes. And never mind what all escapes a lady's man. All youth must feel betrayed by age. I'm reading from a later page, and you can't hear me at your stage, a lady's man. Therefore, my boy, enjoy your prime until your fateful date with time, when you can claim no longer I'm a lady's man. Hey, there's a beauty, you agree? Quite a body, hasn't she? Well, sock it to her once for me. A lady's man. Yeah. A lady's man. A lady's man.
Coming premiere of a new animated film adventure has the whole world in a world of hurt.
Got to be Inside Extra Access tonight for the first part of June 2005.
Hi everybody, I'm Mike DeVere.
And I'm Pat Mungo.
Hollywood has been fashioning feature films out of comic book favorites since Superman and Batman first flew onto the big screen. But some filmmakers have complained that all the great comic book characters have already made the leap to movie stardom.
That's right, Mike. But two renegades from the glamorous world of rap videos have found movie magic in the research of antique advertising expert Ed Kasanevsky.
Yo, this is JJ Smoove from the Urban Video Collective. My auntie's boyfriend had this old newspaper collection, you know what I mean? And now on the front page of the Sunday comics, every Sunday was this green dude and, you know, Kasanevsky man. He knew who the dude was.
It was Peter Payne. It was a gremlin-y type of character. He was green. He stabbed people in their joints and muscles with a pitchfork to induce pain. And he starred in his own comic strip, which in fact was an ad in comic strip form for Ben Gay. Ran on the front page of the Sunday comics for years. He had a lot of adventures where he always ended up stabbing people in their joints and muscles. And he sold a lot of Ben Gay.
This summer, the folks at Touchmount Pictures hope Peter Payne will be selling more movie tickets than Liniment. Peter Payne 1, The Hurting, opens July 4th weekend. And for director Richard Eric Dante, it's been a roller coaster ride straight uphill.
You see, millions of people saw this character every week, but to make him relevant to contemporary audiences, we had to do two things. We had to go deep. We knew from the adverts that Peter Payne liked to make parts of people's bodies hurt, but we didn't know why. What if he had an abusive father with painful joints and muscles, and now his life is consumed by the need to have payback, but now he's targeted by the international pain suppression conspiracy, like a government drug company thing, and he's really the last honest man, except he's green. And second, of course, we had to make everything move extremely fast.
Without my pitchfork, I have no special powers.
Vin Diesel stars as the tortured and torturing hero Peter Payne. But Vin isn't doing interviews to promote the picture. We'll catch up with him soon.
Meantime, J.J. Smoove has high hopes for The Hurting, which marries video game graphics with video game scriptwriting.
Peter Payne, you're dead meat.
Oh, really?
Guaranteed.
Like to see you try it when you're racked with arthritis.
Yo, J.J. Smoove again. You know, in a way, this guy goes from like a comic strip character straight on through to somebody who's more than human, you know. It's mind candy.
We've already got two sequels being animated in North Korea right now. Peter Payne 2, The Healing, and Peter Payne 3, Severe Amputation. That one's a little extreme.
Extreme? Hey, talk to Pat.
No, thanks. Dr. Phil's cured me.
That's it for now, but Inside Extra Access tonight comes rolling back tomorrow with the question, as the Michael Jackson trial ends, what's the next career move for the lookalike on the E-Channel trial recreations?
The answer will have you sipping the Jesus juice, but not me. Till then, I'm Pat Mungo.
And I'm Mike DeVere.
So long from Culver City.
And now, ladies and gentlemen, the apologies of the week.
Sorry.
Well, the first one, I think, has to be this. From Late Night with a guy.
What was the problem?
Well, look, just now that if you've given me the opportunity, I'm extremely sorry for this whole incident, and I regret everything that took place. And, you know, I've apologized to my wife. There's not many things that scare me in this world, but I'm absolutely terrified of disappointing her. We had 9 rooms in that hotel
right.
over a period of 7 days, and everybody was having the same problems. And, you know, I without getting into the detail of it, bottom line is, you know, I did something really stupid.
Mm-hmm.
And don't wish to ever repeat that again. And, you know, actually, while we've got the moment, you know, I would understand that right at the moment that Nesta and his family would be under a great deal of pressure, and I'd like to apologize to them directly for that as well.
And these are the people involved in the incident?
Yeah.
Russell Crowe, ladies and gentlemen, apologizing for the incident to Nesta and his family. I know, I don't read the tabloids either. He was apologizing. And then he broke a silence the next night on Hardball, the silence that he was maintaining there with Dave. Dayline Warsaw, a Polish priest denied he intentionally collaborated with communist authorities in the 1980s while close to Pope John Paul II's entourage, but he apologized to anyone he may have hurt. Allegations that the Reverend Konrad Stanisław Hejmo had been an informer for Poland's communist government were first brought by Poland's Institute for National Remembrance shortly after the late Pope died in April. I was never a conscious denouncer who would aim to harm individuals, my fellow convent brothers, the church hierarchy, or the Holy Church, he wrote in a statement released by the Polish news agency PAP. That's honest. The Polish news agency PAP. They don't smear any. He acknowledged, however, that communist security agents gathered files on him that blew my role out of proportion. Authorities recently made the files available to the state-run institute. The Philippine ambassador to Israel apologized this week to foreign ministry officials for comparing local immigration police to the Nazi secret police. Ambassador Antonio Modeno had compared the tactics used by the police in arrest sweeps to the Gestapo. Israeli authorities have deported hundreds of foreign workers from the Philippines and other countries in recent months. He should have greater sensitivity, said the ministry spokesman Mark Regev. I wish to withdraw the terms Nazi, Gestapo, and racist from the statement I made, and I apologize to the Israeli people for the use of these terms, Modeno wrote. Dateline Beijing, Swiss food and drinks group Nestle apologized yesterday, sometime, to Chinese consumers for high iodine levels found in its Chinese brand Jinpai Growing 3 milk powder. Don Imus apologized this week for a comment by former Imus in the Morning sportscaster Sid Rosenberg, who claimed that actor Tom Cruise is gay. In a statement read on his syndicated radio and TV show, Imus said, the other day Sid said something about Tom Cruise being a homo. Sid meant it as a joke. We know that Tom's not gay. Unquote. We know that. The Hernando County, Florida principal who plagiarized a speech for her commencement address this year has done the same thing before. Springstead High School principal Susan Duval issued a letter of apology this week for failing to credit the author of her plagiarized speech at this year's commencement. But she also acknowledged cribbing from material that someone gave her before delivering last year's commencement speech as well. She began last year's speech saying, "I would like to share some personal thoughts with you." Then, after reciting some class accomplishments, she proceeded to read almost word for word a brief popular collection of sayings, sometimes called "All I Need to Know I Learned from Noah's Ark." She has apologized. The animal rights group People for the Ethical Treatment of Animals has apologized for its eyebrow-raising two-year-old Holocaust on Your Plate campaign, with PETA's leader stating, "It was never our goal to humiliate the victims of the Holocaust." "We know we have caused pain," wrote Ingrid Newkirk. "This was never our intention, and we are deeply sorry." Canadian Prime Minister Paul Martin heard personal stories of loss from grieving relatives of victims of the Air India tragedy this week, saying the experience was very emotional. "It's one of the greatest losses this country has ever suffered in terms of sheer numbers of people." He apologized for the Canadian government over the last 20 years and has stated that he wants answers too, said Sushil Gupta, one of the relatives of the victims. Dateline Nepal, communist rebels apologized this week for making a grave mistake by bombing a civilian bus in an attack that killed 38 people and injured 71, saying they were targeting government security forces. A New York stockbroker who once showcased his financial acumen on cable television programs was sentenced to 13 years and 4 months in prison for bilking 50 investors, many of them elderly, out of $20 million. Todd Eberhard got prison time in exchange for the loss of life savings. "It's an unequal one," said his judge. Eberhard was a frequent guest on financial news programs on cable TV, including CNN's Moneyline. Hello, Lou. Just before sentencing, Eberhard apologized, saying he was, quote, "deeply sorry for what I've done." He requested leniency, saying he looked forward to, quote, "the day when I can rebuild all that I have destroyed and make a neat profit on that." No, he didn't say that part. Dateline London, Fox News has apologized after a presenter described the United Nations as an organization that, quote, "sends peacekeepers to the Congo to rape young children," unquote. The comment was made by former Judge Andrew Napolitano during a debate on the Fox News program The Big Story in April. This is Fox being relayed over to UK, where there are such things as media regulators, because a viewer complained to the media regulator Ofcom about the comment, which Fox News said had been made during an unscripted and emotional debate over the nomination of John Bolton as the new UN ambassador from the U.S. Ofcom said it was a serious allegation. 2 days later, Metropolitano said what he had meant to say was that the UN had sent peacekeepers to the Congo and there have been reports that some of them had raped children. He apologized for the conclusion, for the confusion, said the regulator. "We welcome the apology." Dateline Providence, Rhode Island, right here. A U.S. naval professor has been sentenced to a year of probation for lying about a visit to Cuba to see his mistress. He's the Cuban-born chairman, Alberto Cole, of the Strategic Research Department of the U.S. Naval War College in Newport, where he was this morning. He pleaded guilty in March to lying about the purpose of the visit. He told federal authorities he was visiting a sick aunt. He apologized to his wife and college-age son. A director of the English National Opera apologized Wednesday for loudly booing one of his colleagues at the end of a public performance. Ian McKay shouted derision as Paul Daniel was called on stage for an ovation after his final performance as music director and chief conductor of the English National Opera. McKay, the E&O's director of marketing, had been angered by a newspaper article in which Daniel spoke about the future of the company. Members of the audience complained about McKay's behavior during a May 13th performance of Alban Berg's Lulu to staff at the theater. "The reason for my action was in response to an interview, which I believe damaged the company's reputation," he said. "I now realize my actions were inappropriate, and I express my regret to the audience that night if I distracted them from their enjoyment of the performance." Me, personally, I would welcome a little booing during Lulu, but that's just me. Not Lulu the singer. Dateline Boston, the Department of Social Services is investigating a claim that a substitute teacher choked a 12-year-old boy until he lost consciousness. The teacher allegedly asked the class how long it would take for a student to black out. When students didn't know, she began to choke the boy. school officials apologized to the mother of the boy. Baltimore City Councilman has apologized for his actions that resulted in a crashing his sports utility vehicle shortly after 2 a.m. Monday. He ran in the back of a car whose driver was changing a flat tire. And finally, ladies and gentlemen, top U.S. weapons buyers bypassed normal procedures in an inappropriate rush to acquire $23.5 billion of Boeing aircraft as refueling planes, according to the Pentagon's chief inspector. The Congress has killed the deal after a whistleblower blew the whistle. The top U.S. weapon buyer accepted responsibility for failure to second-guess other players' action on the Tanker deal. Acting Air Force Secretary Michael Dominguez and Chief of Staff General John Jumper also apologized for the scandal, particularly the unprofessional tone of many emails, some of which personally attacked Senator John McCain and his staff. The apologies of the week, ladies and gentlemen, it is, too, a copyrighted feature of this broadcast.
A concert of contours and curves as she slips to and fro. Round the table she says, I buy six meals a day in this crummy cafe, 'cause I see Hazel that way. Hazel's eyes are divine and her hair is so fine, yeah. Hazel's hips have a rhythm so gently controlled that her trips to the kitchen are joy to behold. I love to just sit and gaze at the way Hazel sways when she's carrying trays. Hazel's eyes are divine and her hair is so fine, yeah, but her hips bring the tips. My heart flips when I see Hazel smiling at me. So I say, honey bunch, can I have you for lunch? But Hazel just gives me a hunch and says, don't hand me no line about you think I'm so fine, 'cause here's a tip. Hazel's hip.
This is Le Show, and, you know, truth, ladies and gentlemen, can be a malleable commodity. President George Bush's decision not to sign the United States to the Kyoto Global Warming Treaty was partly a result of pressure from ExxonMobil, as according to the British newspaper The Guardian, and other industries, according to U.S. State Department papers seen by The Guardian. This sort of made the news this week in the United States. The documents reinforce widely held suspicions of how close the company is to the administration and its role in helping to formulate U.S. policy. And meantime, Philip Cooney, the chief of staff on President Bush's Council on Environmental Quality resigned this week, White House officials said. His resignation came 2 days after documents revealed he had repeatedly edited government climate reports in ways that cast doubt on the link between greenhouse gas emissions and rising temperatures. Cooney, his scientific training, ladies and gentlemen, is, let's see, I have it right here. I have his scientific training right here. It is, oh, none. Has no scientific training. But he revised the scientific reports, you see, because he has no scientific training. Dana Perino, a deputy White House press secretary, said he had long been considering his options following 4 years of service in the administration. She said his decision to leave was unrelated to revelations about the documents of him continually editing government climate reports in ways that cast doubt on them. Cooney did not return email messages or phone messages left at his home. Ms. Perino noted the documents in question dated from 2003. Also, it's okay then. He had accumulated many weeks of leave and had decided to resign and take the summer off to spend the time, ladies and gentlemen, together with me now, with his family. I'm still waiting for somebody to resign from the government to spend time with someone else's family, but that'll happen. Before he joined the White House in 2001, Cooney was a lawyer for the American Petroleum Institute. His position was climate team leader, in which he fought restrictions on greenhouse gases. The documents were publicized in Wednesday's New York Times. Most scientists and scientific groups, including the National Academy of Sciences, in a letter released this week, have said the relationship between greenhouse gas emissions and warming is clear enough to justify prompt action by countries to curb emissions. But Myron E. Bell, who for years has fought restrictions on greenhouse gases on behalf of industry groups, said Cooney's actions were part of the normal adjustments to language in government documents to mesh them with policy goals. Sounds like Iraq, doesn't it? Mesh the intelligence with the policy goals, won't you? Quote, the idea that only scientists are able to deal with that is ridiculous, said Mr. Bell. Citizens have got to be able to deal with these things and decipher them too, he said. Reminds me of the 12-year-old girl in San Diego. The judge ordered that she have radiation therapy. And she said, he didn't ask me. Yeah, citizens should weigh in on this stuff. Ladies and gentlemen, speaking of citizens, one of our number is awaiting the verdict from a jury of his peers, Michael Jackson, in Santa Maria, California. The jury is doing something else for the weekend, maybe listening to this broadcast. I won't be swaying you. It's okay. And as you know, a lot of controversial testimony, a lot of differing he said and he said. And he didn't say, because Michael Jackson never took the stand in his own defense, as his attorney had promised he would. But promises in a courtroom, ladies and gentlemen, they're worth about as much as promises in, a hall of the legislature. One piece of testimony, however, which has not been contested, a witness did say that he saw in 1992 or 1993 Michael Jackson on an airplane flight trip with the original accuser, the one that got paid off, saw that Michael Jackson had licked the young man's head. That went unrebutted, but not unsung.
Done. On her way to work one morning down the path alongside the lake, a tender-hearted woman saw a poor half-frozen snake. His pretty colored skin had been all frosted with the dew. Poor thing, she cried, I'll take you in and I'll take care of you. Take me in, tender woman, take me in for heaven's sake. Take me in, tender woman, sighed the snake. She wrapped him up all cozy in a comforter of silk and laid him by the fireside with some honey and some milk. She hurried home from work that night, and soon as she arrived, she found that pretty snake she'd taken in had been revived. Take me in, tender woman, take me in for heaven's sake. Take me in, tender woman, sighed the snake. She clutched him to her bosom, you're so beautiful, she cried. But if I hadn't brought you in by now, you might have died. She stroked his pretty skin again and kissed and held him tight. Instead of saying thanks, the snake gave her a vicious bite. Take me in, tender woman, take me in for heaven's sake. Take me in, tender woman, sighed the snake. I saved you, cried the woman, and you bitten me, but why? You know your bite is poisonous, and now I'm gonna die. Oh, shut up, silly woman, said the reptile with a grin. You knew darn well I was a snake before you took me in. Take me in, tender woman, take me in for heaven's sake. Take me in, tender woman, sighed the snake. Take me in, tender woman, sighed the snake. Take me in, tender woman, sighed the snake.
Ladies and gentlemen, with our farewell to Oscar Brown Jr., that's going to be the farewell for this edition of the show. The program returns next week at the same time over these same stations over NPR worldwide throughout Europe. I can say it. Old and new on the USN 440 cable system in Japan, around the world through the facility of the American Forces Network, up and down the east coast of North America via the shortwave giant WBCQ, the planet 7.415 megahertz shortwave, on channel 108 on Sirius Satellite Radio. Home of Sirius Satellite Radio. Available on your computer whenever you want it at two different locations, harryshear.com and kcrw.com, live and archived. Available almost immediately after broadcast. And available as a free download at audible.com/theshow. And it would be just like remembering to pronounce Mayor Buddy's last name correctly if you'd agree to join with me then, would you? Alrighty, thank you very much. By the way, if you want to find out when the show is streamed on Sundays or whenever any of your favorite public radio shows are available via the internet, check out one of my favorite websites. I have no financial involvement in it. publicradiofan.com, www.publicradiofan.com. The mailing address for this broadcast is lemail, L-E-M-A-I-L, at interworld.net. Le Show Internet Services by Steve Mack. A tip of the Le Show chapeau to the San Diego and Pittsburgh desks for help with today's broadcast. And a big sweeping bow to Steve Conte here in Providence for helping to make today's show ready for air. The show comes to you from Century of Progress Productions and originates through the facilities of KCRW Santa Monica, a community recognized around the world as the home of the homeless.